President Trump announced today on Twitter that he will ban transgender people from serving in the military in any capacity. That's a sweeping reversal of an Obama-era policy aimed at opening the military to transgender people. Also today, and likely all week, the Senate is in the midst of an intense debate over whether and how to repeal and maybe replace the Affordable Care Act.
And wither Jeff Sessions. Let's bring in our political analyst in the right corner, Paris Denard, our Republican strategist. Hi, Paris.
I am in the right, the correct corner. You're very correct, Robin.
Oh, and on the left, punching above her weight, Angela Rye, a Democratic strategist. Hi, Angela.
Hi, I'm never punching above my weight. I'm ready for game time, Robin. I'm ready.
And Paris, I'm going to start with you because the Republicans are in power and in the news. Lawmakers were able to vote to begin debate on the Republican health care plans last night, but barely. And today, President Trump took Lisa Murkowski of Alaska to task on Twitter. She was one of two, Susan Collins of Maine the other, who didn't even vote to start debate on health care. Do Republicans risk what the Hill called this circular firing squad? They don't repeal Obamacare. It's not looking good. But in the process, they take down fellow Republicans like Murkowski.
Well, you know what? I don't know if the president really is alone in his dismay with the two Republicans who did not vote yesterday to move this to the floor, because the Republicans have had 7 years to come up with a plan, and for the Senate to refuse, or for senators to not even want to get this to debate, to not even allow it to offer amendments, to offer an opportunity for the American people to have a better chance to have access to affordable health care is horrible. And so I think it was the appropriate thing for the American people to hear that the president wants this debate and he wants these amendments and he wants a better bill. And I think at the end of the day, that's what matters most.
Well, what about the possible end results, Angela? As you look at this, do you think that they're going to be able to get something passed and at least partially repeal the Affordable Care Act?
I think they're going to be able to get something passed. I think the question, and it's, I think, frankly, the billion-dollar question is what? When you consider what Paris just mentioned, which is, you know, it's a shame they wouldn't even allow this to get to the floor. I think what's more shameful is the fact that we have a health care law in place with Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, which was designed to ensure that health care was accessible and became more of a right to the American people. This bill, frankly, is one that would allow for tax credits and cutting taxes for the rich. That has nothing to do with affordability of health care to millions of American people. And that's if they rely upon the same health care plan put forth and passed in the House. I don't know what they're going to be able to move forward, but I think the irony of the timing of what's happening with Senator McCain, and of course we wish that he gets and pray that he gets well soon, is here he is in an elitist position where he can afford the best of the best. And he has access to the best of the best because of status and some amount of wealth. He's not the richest, but some amount of wealth. Compared to folks everywhere, all throughout this country, regardless of where they live geographically, who can't afford quality health care. We know better than anyone else that the time is now to compromise on what's before us and to just strengthen the health care plan that we have instead of trying to sabotage it and put forth something that may not even work.
Paris, what role do you think John McCain will have? Talk about battle scarred. You know, he came back with that scar along his brow. I mean, really quite something to see that. Didn't hide it. And of course, there's evoking memories of Ted Kennedy with the same illness coming in and battling for Obama legislation. John McCain making that plea, you know, unlike Kennedy. Kennedy wanted to go even further than Democrats did. He wanted even to go further on health care to the left. McCain begging for compromise. Is he going to get it?
I hope. And I think Angela was a little bit wrong. It's not the billion-dollar question. It's literally the trillion-dollar question.
Yeah.
Is can we do something for the American people? And I think that's why Senator McCain, who I know I've known for many years, I'm from Arizona, this is why he decided to come and fight back, because this issue is very, very important to the American people, but also to the people in Arizona who are his constituents that saw Obamacare premiums rise up to 100 and 115 or more percent. And so this is an issue that has to get beyond partisanship. They must come together. And I think we have a president who wants to bring Democrats to the table. He said it, and we should take him at his word.
Well, he's been going after Democrats on Twitter throughout this entire process. You think he wants to bring Democrats into the process?
I think if it means for him to get a deal that is a better deal than Obamacare so he can get a win under his belt for the American people, yes, the president will want to bring Democrats to the table, because we've seen he can't even get Republicans to have enough courage to, like Murkowski and Collins, to bring this to the floor.
But, you know, I know we probably have to move on, but just really quick, I think we're doing a real disservice to Senators Murkowski and Collins. There's a reason for that. This bill should have been considered in regular order. There should have been an opportunity to consider all of the options on the table. It should have been properly scored by CBO with enough time for the senators to consider what's before them. So that's really why they voted against.
People
it's a process
in
thing.
Both their states, Maine and Alaska, are going to stand to lose their insurance. But
yes,
we do have to move on.
Well, there's so much going on today. Yeah. And let me get your thoughts, both of you, on President Trump's Twitter announcement that he will ban all transgender people from the military, reversing an Obama-era policy aimed at opening the military to transgender people. Paris, what's the point of this? Why now? I mean, he's saying that it's about medical costs, but we're talking about a few thousand people in a very big military.
You know, I don't know, but what I have made a conscious decision is not to question our military leaders. And the president said that after consultation with the generals and the military leaders at the Department of Defense, they came to this conclusion. And I think if they came to the conclusion, I think it's one that I have to respect.
Angela?
Yeah, I think that this is more about him trying to yet again take away something that President Obama worked very diligently on. As you all know, this was scheduled to be implemented on July 1st. General Mattis delayed this announcement so that they could really assess whether or not this would have any impact on the troops. So not only did Donald Trump issue this, you know, this edict, technically that's almost what it is, on Twitter today, he blindsided the Department of Defense. Here they are in working groups trying to figure this out, and I don't agree with delaying the implementation of it, but I definitely don't agree with completely snatching the rug out from them for $2 to maybe $8 million, when we know that his border wall is going to cost billions. And that is a taxpayer expense. So he should have been a little bit more considerate, perhaps even of one of his surrogates, Caitlyn Jenner, you know, to say that there's nobody in the military who can be transgender and serve in any capacity is a great affront. And you think about people who serve as lawyers and doctors and engineers and all of the ways in which they impact lives.
Yep.
That's problematic.
This
and
one correction.
There are 18 countries.
One correction, Mexico is going to pay for that wall.
Mexico is not paying for that wall. Stop telling that lie.
We don't hear a lot of that anymore. But Paris, I do want to ask you about the president's attacks on his attorney general, Jeff Sessions, you know, yesterday at a press conference, today in tweets. Why is he doing this? Conservatives like fellow Alabaman Richard Shelby said flat out, Sessions is being brutalized by President Trump and doesn't deserve it. You know, why would Trump risk losing conservatives who back Sessions when he's already lost the moderates?
I'll put it to you this way. I think attack and brutalize, I think it is overusing those words. I think the president is just articulating his frustrations with some of the choices that the attorney general has made. Everyone knows that he is not pleased that he recused himself. We know that he wishes he was going after the things that he feels were illegal that Secretary Clinton has done. This is what President Trump does. He airs his frustrations out in public. But I also think this. I think what he was trying to do and is trying to do is to gauge where the American people, but more importantly, where the Republican base is as it relates to Attorney General Sessions being in that role. If he sees that the blowback is so strong that they support him, he'll probably not move in a direction of getting rid of him. But if he shows that there's no support for him and everyone thinks that he's doing a horrible job, like the CBC and sometimes Angela Rye on this program, then he'll get rid of them. But I think he was just testing the waters to see how strong of support he had for him. But at the end of the day, the president knows that the people that work for him serve at his pleasure. When the pleasure is gone, he has every right to get rid of people.
When the pleasure is gone? Sorry, I had to comment on this. So just real quick, I think it's important for us to note that Donald Trump thinks he is Simba in The Lion King, where he just can't wait to be king. He's in the wrong doggone country for this. And the reality of it is Jeff Sessions is supposed to be serving the country, even if he is in Donald Trump's cabinet. I don't feel bad for Jeff Sessions, but it's absolutely regular Donald Trump campaign bullying behavior, and it's absurd. Donald Trump should understand that if there were any laws violated, if, for example, Jeff Sessions forgot to report some pretty serious things during his confirmation hearing, that's why he had to recuse himself. And we shouldn't get past those facts. As much as he's throwing these tantrums, welcome to the presidency, Donald Trump. Being commander-in-chief was a little bit harder than you thought it would be.
Oh, Angela, Hakuna Matata, don't worry. It'll be okay.
Oh, I'm worried.
Good. We're getting to the Lion King references. Paris, real quick here. We just have a few seconds left.
Yeah.
But what did you make of this tape that was the two senators caught on tape, Susan Collins and Jack Reed of Rhode Island, and they were saying about President Trump, Reed says, I think he's crazy.
And that they're worried.
Collins says, I know, I'm worried. Real quick.
That's their personal opinion about the president. I would just hope that's not going to be on the tape. I'd hope that they see that the president's trying to do some good things and get on board with the agenda they're trying to do for the country. But if that's how they feel, it's unfortunate. Millions of Americans don't agree.
Well, more to the point,
millions do.
Well, more to the point, they're also worried about a budget deal and the government being paralyzed.
Yeah.
So we'll take that up another time. Paris Denard, a Republican strategist, and Angela Rye, a Democratic strategist as well, landing a couple blows. Thank you both.
Thank you, friend.
Thanks, guys.
Is it possible to love too much, to love everyone, even strangers, all of them, and to trust that everyone, the bus driver, the waitress in the diner, the guy panhandling on the corner, loves you back? Well, that is Williams syndrome. It's been called the opposite of autism. People with autism sometimes can't make eye contact. People with Williams can't stop, will come within inches and tell you you're the greatest thing that ever happened to them. It sounds charming. It can be at times. But imagine having a child who can't accept that not everyone should be trusted or hugged. Other traits include heart defects and distinct elf-like facial features. Author Jennifer Latson spent 3 years chronicling the challenges and joys faced by a single mom in Connecticut raising a son with Williams. She joins us. And Jennifer, you've changed names. You call the mother Gail, the son Eli. Start with Gail, a young mother, former hard rock and roller, lives a little on the edge, suddenly finds herself trying to become an expert on the syndrome that almost no one's heard of.
Right, exactly. And she actually got kind of lucky, although she didn't feel lucky at the time, that her son was diagnosed relatively young, because some people with Williams might not get diagnosed. It's a rare enough disorder. About 1 in 10,000 people has it. Unless a cardiologist happens to notice that you have a rare heart defect that's unique to Williams, a lot of people just could go years and years or their whole lives without getting diagnosed.
Or getting misdiagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about the heart defect. There are physical and emotional symptoms of this disorder, and it runs a gamut. Not everybody has all of them. What are some of the other things? There's a particular way the faces of people with Williams syndrome look.
Yes. So originally, Williams syndrome was actually called elfin face syndrome. So these characteristics are like what you would see in a storybook drawing of an elf. Upturned nose, narrow chin, pointed ears. People with Williams tend to look more like each other than they do their own family members. And it's a very cute elfin face.
Well, in fact, as you write, we're realizing now that perhaps some characters from literature who had cute elfin faces and this ability to just love everyone, Puck in Midsummer's Night's Dream, may have had Williams.
Well, yeah, and folklorists believe that the actual fairy tales that had elves in them might have been kind of inventions to explain why these seemingly otherworldly people were here with us. So they weren't like the rest of us. Where did they come from? And you see the depictions of elves not only have those facial features, but they also have very outgoing, friendly, warm personalities like people with Williams. And they help people. They tell stories. They are very musical, which is also, those are some of the traits that go along with Williams.
But in Eli's case, they maybe don't remember to put their pants on, or they have trouble cleaning themselves. I mean, it is a full-time job for Gail to raise him.
Yes, there are symptoms of Williams that are kind of a strange grouping. So you have intellectual disability. It's around what people with Down syndrome have, so an average IQ around 50. But with that intellectual disability, there are abilities. Like, people with Williams tend to be very verbally gifted. They're very imaginative, and they're just very chatty in general and tend to be great at small talk.
Mm. Well, we start falling in love with Eli, but I don't want to leave Gail yet. What a mother. I mean, it's heartbreaking in some ways as she holds on to, you know, maybe he doesn't have this, maybe he doesn't have this, then he does. And then how she has to form this relationship with him where she has to listen to him ask her questions 1,000 times in a row. His enthusiasm for vacuum cleaners and floor polishers, a reaction to sound initially. They have a hard time taking in sounds.
Yes, they have something called hyperacusis. So their sense of hearing is very good, but it's also painful to hear certain sounds because it's so good. You know, they hear things so loudly. But then as they grow up, it often becomes a source of fascination. And that's what happened with Eli. He would watch YouTube videos of people vacuuming their floors. Mm. He especially loved this floor scrubber, the Tennant 5400. he loves that model. Every time I see one, like at the Home Depot or something, I'm tempted to take a picture and send it to him because he would just be thrilled.
Well, as an infant, he wanted to hug everybody. As he got older, Gail has to, you know, instruct him on, you know, shaking hands. You cannot hug everyone. What was it like to have this come your way, this affection?
At first, like you said, I was so just in love with Eli, and he's so adorable and charming, and you just want to be around him all the time. But what I really came to appreciate was how amazing Gail was. Mm. And to me, she really became the hero of this story, because she did go through this struggle every single day. She never got tired of it, that I could tell. You know, she never reached the end of her rope. And she was just like a one-woman anti-hug police. She was just on top of what was going on at all times and just trying to pull her son out of harm's way. But also, her big challenge in the years that I followed him was that kind of awkward transition of, when you're a little boy who hugs everyone, that's adorable. When you're a grown man who hugs everyone, that's assault. So she really wanted to prevent him from being taken advantage of, but also just becoming a pariah. Even when he knew it was wrong on an intellectual level, he just couldn't stop.
You know, that kind of gets at his awareness of what's going on, because, again, he's happy all the time or most of the time. And so as kids are maybe not being kind, as kids can be, he sort of doesn't notice it. But there's a point where they're behind a woman at a counter in a store, and Gail thinks this woman's being way too nice. And the woman turns around, and sure enough, she has the features. And Eli says, she's like me. So he knows?
That was a stunning moment. I think Gail was more surprised than anyone. She had talked to him a little bit about Williams syndrome. I mean, he's not quite sophisticated enough to understand the nuances. So the fact that he recognized this woman was incredible. But then when Gail said, well, what does that mean? She's like you. He couldn't really explain himself. And she's asked him before, well, what is Williams syndrome? And I think because he's only gone to these sort of social events that are related to the Williams Syndrome Association, he said, well, Williams Syndrome is, it's like a party. She said, well, that's not far off.
It got very tough as he became a teenager and the hormones kick in. And, you know, he was touching himself, touching others inappropriately in school. Seeing him, you know, go through that period of being incredibly inappropriate now that he's older, what's his future?
Well, that was the number one concern for Gail throughout this whole time that I spent with them is, you know, he's growing physically. He's becoming an adult. He's angsty, but he doesn't have really the emotional or intellectual maturity to articulate what he's feeling. And sort of what ends up happening is, as he's maturing, he's also regressing. So during his early teens, he was throwing a lot of tantrums. He just didn't know how to express what he was feeling. And so he sometimes lashed out with physical violence against his mom and against his grandmother at one point. That was just really so heartbreaking because he seemed like he was literally beside himself. He just didn't know how to convey or deal with these overwhelming feelings. And as soon as they subsided, you know, he was back to his lovable, cheerful, hugging self. But that was Gail's concern, is how is he ever going to be a mature, independent adult? Will he ever be independent? And those are some of the questions that she's still sorting out.
And we should say that there are some people with Williams. There was one young girl you profiled who is, you know, gets A's in every class and is a classical musician. So there's a spectrum, and we'll see where Eli goes. But meanwhile, there are two moments where just reading the paragraph, you know, you cry. And one of them is Eli graduating from eighth grade. He goes up on the stage. Gail's there ready to record it. He gets up there and they cheer him, this huge ovation. And she realized they were fond of him.
Middle school was very tough for Eli, and there were some moments where he was getting bullied and teased, and Gail thought, oh my gosh, is this going to be the rest of his life? And that graduation moment really affirmed what she had hoped, which was these kids were rooting for him. I mean, they were, in their own way, as protective of and supportive of him as she was, and that was obvious to her, too, when she visited the school once and got to know how much these kids really cared for him.
This was in his eighth grade science class. They were studying genetic syndromes, and she came to talk about Williams. Eli was not in the room. They were asking her sincere questions. What's going to happen to him? They wanted to know what was going to happen to him. And there's another moment, which we have to mention. He gets to run the floor polisher.
Oh, no, spoiler alert. This was something he was allowed to do every Friday in high school, his freshman year of high school, as part of vocational training. And he had begged for the chance to use this floor scrubber. And it was just amazing to watch how much joy there was. I think this was one of Gail's central struggles as she sort of shifted her understanding of what it would mean to be a parent once she found out that her kid had Williams. When he was born, there were all these possibilities that she could imagine for him, and she didn't necessarily think he would be a rocket scientist or the president or a brain surgeon, but those weren't off the table. And then she found out, okay, he has an intellectual disability. What is that going to mean? And when she thought, well, he might do some kind of, you know, low-skill labor, she was devastated and then wasn't sure that he would even be able to do that much. So when he finally was able to have the sustained attention and the discipline to clean a whole floor, I mean, that was just amazing for both of them.
Jennifer Latson, her new book is The Boy Who Loved Too Much, tells of the boy with Williams syndrome and the mother who raises him. Jennifer, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And Williams families, your thoughts are so welcome at hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Sunbasket. Sunbasket makes it easy to cook nutritionist-approved meals in your own kitchen with organic, non-GMO ingredients from farms and fishermen sent directly to your door. Choose from paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and family options. You'll get pre-measured ingredients and easy-to-follow directions and get dinner on the table in 30 minutes. It's healthy cooking designed to fit your busy lifestyle, and it's delicious. Here and Now listeners get their first three meals free at sunbasket.com/now.
The United Kingdom is pledging to ban the sale of new gas and diesel cars by 2040. It's part of an effort to improve air quality, and it's similar to a plan that France announced earlier this month. Norway is also trying to phase out gas cars by 2025, as is India by 2030. Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. She joins us from New York. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, tell us more about this ban in the UK, because this is part of a larger clean air strategy.
It is, and it's happening in part because the UK has a pollution problem. You may remember there were some sensational headlines at the beginning of the year that pollution in the UK was worse than Beijing, and we all know the problems they struggle with. That appears to be a one-off set of circumstances, but the UK does lag behind EU standards, and a lot of it is due to car emissions. So this is the government's latest attempt to try to get in front of that, but already critics chiming in saying that 2040 deadline doesn't do enough to address the immediate problem right now.
Well, yeah. Electric, hybrid, and fuel cell cars in the UK made up less than 3% of the vehicles sold in 2015. How are they going to meet this goal?
Yeah, it's pretty ambitious, isn't it? I think getting the car makers on board may not be as hard as it sounds. Many of them have been planning for this type of thing. They've been investing heavily in electric and hybrid. The harder part of the equation is getting the consumers, especially if electric cars are pricier. That's why a lot of environmentalists are pushing the government to get more, and governments around the world, by the way, to get more aggressive with incentives. Scrappage schemes, which I love, is what they call them in the UK. But they want to give consumers an incentive to switch. And that's especially important when you're looking at countries like India and China, where many families and young people are buying cars for the first time.
All right. Well, while we're talking about cars and car makers, Ford today reported higher profits in the second quarter. General Motors also reported better than expected quarterly profits. But there are still concerns about a possible downturn in the auto industry. What's going on?
Yeah, you know, during the financial crisis, everybody put off buying a car. That came back and really pushed us to record levels as everybody replaced. And we knew it wasn't sustainable. So we are seeing that plateau and moderate. But analysts are worried about what the future looks like. And, you know, it's interesting, Jeremy, it's not just sales. They increasingly want to know how these companies plan to deal with Silicon Valley, right? The trend toward all those driverless cars we keep hearing about. Ford is seen to be behind the curve in that respect. There's a lot of thought that that's part of the reason Mark Fields may have been pushed out. GM does have a partnership with Lyft. I spoke to the head of driverless technology there this week, and he reiterated they're not interested in building cars. They are happy to partner with GM. That seems to give investors a little bit more confidence in Mary Barra at GM, and it's helped their stock.
I guess when Lyft and Uber get into self-driving cars, they don't have to deal with the big issues that are going on about how much they're paying their employees.
Yeah. And, you know, listen, when you're talking about driverless cars, the list of challenges is endless, including regulators, right? It's so great to build all this stuff. If you're not allowed on the road, what good is it going to do? But they really believe this is the future. They're building a facility in Palo Alto, moving deeper into that. And it makes sense if you think about it. They have all these cars driving around, right, mapping all the cities. They have all this information they're gathering. But it does raise a lot of interesting questions. Are regulators going to go for it? And what happens to all these drivers, right? They employ about 700,000 drivers. Are they going to go away? They tell me no. Their role will just change. They'll become like the concierge, sort of. Well, but that depends on what you think about technology, I suppose.
That's Maggie Lake, who hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Maggie, thanks as always.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's take a few minutes now for the Here and Now DJ sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Bo Leibowitz is a jazz DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. Bo, welcome back.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And you've got a range of jazz music for us today. First, you wanted us to hear from the late jazz bass guitarist Jaco Pastorius. This is Reza, Giant Steps, from a live performance in New York in 1982 that's being reissued. And Jaco Pastorius, by the way, played with Joni Mitchell and Weather Report, among others. He died in 1987 after a fight with a bouncer at a Florida nightclub. Tell us more about what we're listening to here.
Well, this is his so-called word-of-mouth big band. As you mentioned, he's probably best known for his work with Weather Report in the late 70s and the early 80s. And then when he left Weather Report, he formed this big band, the word-of-mouth big band. And they were only together a couple of years, and as you mentioned, Jaco had many mental problems. And this performance stems from an NPR show, Jazz Alive, from 1982, recorded at Avery Fisher Hall, and previously unreleased on CD, and it's very exciting stuff. This particular tune, Reza, starts out in a kind of primordial fashion with the bass and percussion building to a solo by Jaco, who was one of the monster electric bass players of all time. And then it morphs into John Coltrane's Giant Steps, featuring also a solo by a gentleman by the name of Othello Molyneux on the steel pans. And then back to the original composition, Reza, from Jaco.
And when you say he was a monster electric bass player, he also called himself the greatest bass player in the world. What made him so great?
Well, it's just a combination of technique, ideas. He was sort of known as the Jimi Hendrix of the jazz world in his day.
All right, well, now to the L.A. jazz pianist and composer. This is Bill Cunliffe, with Blame It on My Youth. Bill Cunliffe won a Grammy in 2009 for Best Musical Arrangement. He's also worked with Frank Sinatra. What else should we know about him?
Well, he's just a wonderful piano player and a fabulous arranger. He's been in L.A. for quite a while, and this particular recording has some of the finest of L.A. musicians, including Terrell Stafford, who is the trumpet player featured on this song that was written by Oscar Levant. If you remember Oscar Levant from the movies, he was always the sidekick to the hero, you know, playing piano a la Hoagy Carmichael in a lot of these movies. But he wrote the music for this, Blame It on My Youth. And this is a beautiful rendition, I think, because it starts out in sort of atonal fashion and then coalesces and ends with a wonderful solo cadenza by the trumpeter Terrell Stafford.
You also wanted us to hear from the Detroit jazz drummer, Lewis Hayes. Let's listen to this, and I'm going to have you explain the name in a minute, but it's called Echoro. So tell us, first of all, what Echoro is all about.
Well, this is a tribute to Horace Silver, his first boss. He joined Horace Silver's quintet in 1956 and was there for about 3 years. So Echora, or I don't know how to pronounce this myself, quite frankly. Echoro, Echora. Anyway, it's Horace backwards is what it is. And Lewis Hayes played with some major, major figures. I mean, he started off with Horace for 3 years, and then he played with Cannonball Adderley for about 7 years, and then Oscar Peterson. He replaced Ed Thigpen in Oscar Peterson's group from 1965 to 1967. So just a straight-ahead pleasure is this particular CD.
You know, I was at a jazz performance recently in New York, and I remember just watching the drummer and thinking to myself, how in the world do they do that? Because you're not just keeping a beat. You've got to, you know, just go with it. Go with the other performers as they're doing it, but make it sound like it's not just an absolute mess.
Well, it's conversation. It requires listening, and you make your accents where you can, and voila.
Not easy, probably.
Probably not.
Okay. All right. Up next, we have the bassist Linda Mahon Oh. This is called Walk Against Wind. Linda Mahon Oh was born in Malaysia. She was raised in Australia, and she played piano and bassoon, and then in high school she played a lot of Red Hot Chili Peppers on the electric bass. Tell us more about her.
Well, you know, I read that too, which I had no idea, but I really like this recording. It's all original compositions, and that particular piece is a tribute to the mime Marcel Marceau, in the sense of, if you can picture walking against wind, you know, palms up, legs splayed and churning, and the opening figure between the bass and the guitar gives that sort of Sisyphus-type feel to it, of somebody pushing a boulder up a hill or something. At least that's my, that was my impression of it.
You have one more for us. This is from the longtime American jazz pianist Ahmad Jamal. This is called Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child. Kind of cheery for such a depressing title.
Yes, no, that was my first thought. I mean, this is a very mournful, traditional spiritual taken in a rather jaunty fashion. And by the way, happy birthday to Ahmad Jamal, who turned 87 earlier this month.
And he has put out a lot of music over the years.
Yes, well, he gained fame early on for one particular recording, Live at the Pershing. And that was when he was very young. But he's made tons of records, and they're still all sound good. And he was also Miles Davis's favorite piano player. And Miles sort of incorporated Ahmad's use of space in his playing.
That's Bo Leibowitz, a jazz DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. Bo, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Jeremy. Nice to be back.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. Just go to Spotify and search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Plans have been showing up at town halls and lawmakers' offices for months. Yesterday, voices were raised in the Senate chambers as senators deliberated.
Sergeant-at-Arms will restore order in the chamber.
Protesters chanting, "Don't kill us, kill the bill." Well, one of the groups protesting is the national disability rights nonprofit ADAPT. Latoya Maddox with ADAPT's Philadelphia chapter joins us now. Hi, Latoya.
Hi.
And we understand you have arthrogryposis, multiplex congenita.
Yes.
What does that mean? What does that do to you?
It's a bone muscle disorder, so I can't walk or move my arms the way able-bodied people can. I'm permanently in a sitting position and have really bad scoliosis in my back.
Yeah, well, sorry. I'm very sorry. And yet, you've been going out with others in wheelchairs and protesting. Why? What is it about the Republican moves that you think will directly affect you?
They're trying to take away Medicaid, which doesn't have anything to do with the Affordable Care Act. They just want the money to give it to the 1% and have us put back in institutions.
Well, there have been cuts suggested to Medicaid. There have been tax cuts suggested for the very wealthy in some of the Republican plans. But do you really think that coverage would be taken away from you, someone confined to a wheelchair? The talk is of taking back some of the Medicaid expansion that included able-bodied people. Do you really think you'd be included in this?
Yes. I remember when I first moved out of the nursing home, before they did the expansion, I was only getting 5 hours of attendant care a day. So most of the day I was by myself. She would set me up most of the time with food and everything because I'm pretty self-sufficient, even though I have no use of my arms or legs. Once I'm in my wheelchair, I'm fine. But before the expansion, if I was sick or something, I was just basically on my own. I would sometimes call a family member to see if they could come help me out. I was left in a bed a few times by attendants. So, I mean, the expansion allowed me to get more hours added to my care. If something like me being sick, having a stomach virus, or just not feeling like getting out the bed, I still have somebody there with me versus somebody leaving and me being stuck and then coming back later on during the day.
Yeah, so the expansion did give you more coverage. Look, you have been involved in some of these protests. We saw those pictures, the protests from your group ADAPT in front of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's offices, and people from ADAPT lifted out of their wheelchairs and removed by security. You could not be at that protest because your son was graduating that day, but you were at another protest at Republican Senator Pat Toomey's office in your home state of Pennsylvania. A couple of things. First of all, do you worry when you see these pictures of people in wheelchairs being lifted out of them? Do you worry about your own safety?
Yeah, because everybody has a different disability, so there's certain ways you need to pick people up. I know for myself, you have to link your fingers together across my chest and hands under my legs. And if somebody lets go any part of my body, I have no way to stand or to support myself if I'm falling. So I'm going to hit the ground hard.
Well, I wouldn't want that. But obviously, you feel strongly enough about this that you and others in your group have been out at these protests. Look, do you think, as some are saying, and certainly Democrats are claiming this, but do you think you've made a difference?
Yes, because without our voices being out on the street, they would have been on to their next steps. All right, how are we going to eradicate, medicate? So I believe that us being in the street has helped a lot because it shows that we're not scared to be out in the street. We're not scared to get lifted up out of our wheelchairs. We're not scared to get dragged out of offices. We're going to continue on doing what we do until Medicaid is put on the table in the bill and left alone.
Look, ADAPT has been quite incredible. There was a 60-hour sit-in at Colorado Senator Cory Gardner's office. 11 activists slept for two consecutive nights in a small room with inflatable pool toys to sleep on. Four ADAPT activists arrested in the Houston offices of Senator John Cornyn in Texas. Five were arrested in the Philadelphia offices of Senator Toomey. You were there. But, you know, people say, oh, these are just professionals. A lot of these protesters who are out there are backed by MoveOn.org or Our Revolution, which is a spinoff from Bernie Sanders. You know, these are paid professional protesters. You say what?
I don't get paid for this. I work part time as of right now, so I'm taking days off from work to do this. I'm sending my son to his aunt, his godmom, his grandmother, so I could be out doing this. I'm spending a lot of time away from my personal life to do this, and no, I am not getting paid for this, nor is anybody else in ADAPT getting paid for this.
Latoya Maddox, Medicaid recipient, protesting the Republican health care plan with the disability rights group ADAPT. Latoya, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
And by the way, she mentioned her 6-year-old son. He has asthma, and she's also worried he'll lose his care because it'll be a pre-existing condition. We'll check back with her. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.